inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
Jeremiah Emanuel is a youth activist, public speaker, and entrepreneur. He started engaging with his local community at the age of 4, campaigning with the Nelson Mandela School Foundation about several issues that affected young people. In 2011, he was elected into the UK Youth Parliament and later became a young mayor for London. Aged 15, he founded the BBC Radio 1 and One Extra Youth Council and created a youth consultancy enterprise. He is now a member of the Gates Foundation, a youth ambassador for the Big Change Charitable Trust, and a founding member of the Conduit in London. In 2017, he was awarded a British Empire Medal. Today, he's one of the most highly anticipated authors of Stormzy's publishing house, Murky Books. His autobiography, Dreaming in a Nightmare, Finding a Way Forward in a World That's Holding You Back, is set for release in August. In it, he weaves personal setbacks and successes into a broader look at Britain today. Powerful and moving, it's a truth-telling toolkit for young people facing everything from homelessness to knife crime.
Now, I was walking through my area and I was stopped and searched. I was put in the back of a police van and it was far from the best experience, Sam. Far from the best experience. Like, it was just absolutely humiliating. And I've described this to everyone around the table. And then I described the fact that a couple days earlier, I was actually in 10 Downing Street with the Prime Minister, then David Cameron, having a reception and getting an opportunity to help switch on the Christmas lights on the tree outside.
Unbelievable. And
when I shared this story to everyone around the table, again, I'm so desensitized, Sam. Again, cool. I did go through with like the complaints procedure and all of that, but I was so desensitized. I'm with the Prime Minister on Monday, and then Friday I'm walking through Brixton in the back of a police van getting searched.
Hi, Jeremiah. So great to welcome you to AKQA Insight. For the benefit of our listeners, we've both known each other for many, many years now. Jeremiah came to AKQA with a unique service and ability to connect brands with underrepresented youth groups, and we've worked together ever since. We've also both taken on the Virgin Strive Challenge, which was a pretty incredible experience. And I don't know about you, Jeremiah, but it's probably one of the hardest challenges I've ever taken on. So it's going to be great to chat to you today. Your connection to young people and your awareness of what they're doing and how they're feeling is phenomenal. So today I'd love to discuss the effect of the current pandemic on the youth. And they've grown up in a connected world and already inherited many challenges. But today they now have many, many more. I'd love to hear your insights into their mindsets, their lives, and how they're surviving. I'd also love to hear your observations on the positives that we can take from all of this and what that means for the future. I think it will be invaluable to our audience. So welcome to AKQA Insight, Jeremiah. How are you?
I'm good, Sam. So good to have the opportunity to sit down with you and talk in this setting. You know, we're in some crazy times at the moment. So as a young entrepreneur, I've sort of had to find different ways to adapt to the current situation. But yeah, really, really happy to sit down with you to talk today.
Much like AKQA Insight today, both remotely dialing in and using new technologies to be able to talk to each other and share it with the rest of the world. So it's great to have you. So how have you seen the pandemic affect the younger generation? I mean, you live in a city that is built around close communities. You know, what happens to the youth when that is taken away?
I think, you know, it's a major issue for young people. You know, I grew up in Brixton, South London, and already young people from my community already had a lack of opportunities. You know, there was already not enough to do and not enough opportunities before the pandemic arrived. So as you can imagine, if everyone's now at home, there's actually like a limited amount of things to do. I guess it's had its pros and cons. If we sort of started on the cons, you know, I would say mental health is a massive thing that I don't think has been spoken about enough. especially for young people who have been isolated in their homes for some of them up to like 2 months. So I think for me, it was just looking at the effect of my community and the fact that the majority of these young people who already had nothing to do have been completely cut and taken away from their communities. There's no going outside. There's no playing in the park. And the thing that hurts me the most are the young people who live on my estate that I grew up on, because many of them don't have green areas or green spaces to play in. So the majority of them have to sort of stay in their flat on a council estate with a limited amount of things that they can actually get done in a day. So I think if we're talking about my community, I've definitely seen the negative effects of this pandemic sort of impact young people. But I do recognise that at the same time, it does come along with its pros. And I have seen many young people sort of trying to capitalise off of this current moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, hopefully a lot of them will look to you and your entrepreneurship and you know, use that creativity. Have you been chatting to any of them? Have you seen any inspiring things that they've been doing?
Yeah, I've been inspired by so many young people. For example, I had a group of young people from New York who hit me up, and one of them actually used to live in Brixton, but she went over to New York to study. So they had like a digital sort of music and arts conference they put together. I actually took part in it not too long ago. And this was like super, super exciting. You know, I've spoken on some of the biggest stages from Wembley Arena to the O2. I've had the opportunity to speak across loads of different unis in the UK, from Cambridge to LSE. But actually, for the first time, sitting in front of my laptop with 100 people in the audience, it was just like an incredible feeling. And to think that a young person from Brixton that can move to New York can come up with an idea like that, you know, it was really impactful. So that was one example for me. And other examples, you know, just young people thinking, how can I better my situation?
Yeah.
And I guess we've had a bit of chatter on social media, because following the pandemic, you had loads of posts from like business pages and motivational speakers and entrepreneurs. And many people are saying that you should use this time to get something done.
Yeah.
And when I saw the backlash to it and people saying, well, you don't need to do anything, you know, don't feel forced to do anything and whatever, I did sort of understand it. But I feel now is the best time to sort of really focus on yourself. You know, unfortunately, there was a bereavement in my family. I unfortunately lost my godmother following the pandemic, and that really impacted me. I think for like the first 3 or 4 weeks when all of this was going on, my head was sort of all over the place. It's almost like all of my plans that I had for the whole 2020 just came to an end. So the first 3 or 4 weeks, I was sort of sitting around at home, sort of trying to figure out how am I supposed to sort of get the best out of this situation. Because again, both of my businesses sort of require you to meet with people in person and sit down with them and sort of like host discussions. So for me, after the first 3 or 4 weeks, I sort of said to myself, look, I can continue sitting here, sort of really upset that my businesses are heavily affected. I could be really upset that my plans for like my book, for example, which I would love to go into later, was sort of brought to an end. You had to push it back. So instead of like discussing the problems, I sort of said to myself, what is the solution? How can I capitalize and feel comfortable in this moment in time? And for me, I sort of sat down and looked at all of my skills. I looked at all of the things that I had done in the past. And I sort of said to myself, if I'm not allowed to leave my house, what can I get up to?
Yeah, I'd love to hear. And you know, and I'm sorry to hear about the bereavement. I'm sure that must have been even tougher in today's world as well. And you're an inspirational character, and I'm sure, you know, I saw the music conference. Actually, I saw you post that. I think it was yesterday, wasn't it, on African culture and music and stuff. It looked really, really cool. Yeah, and the youth consultancy was how we both met, wasn't it? I remember you you came into the AKQA studio and met with myself and Ajaz. And I mean, how old were you then? You were like, what, 20?
I was very young. I was probably 16.
Yeah.
I was in year 11, so I was in my final year at school.
I remember you had to get back for school, I think, after the meeting.
Yeah, I had to go back to school. Yeah. So the way it happened, I work closely with a charity, very close to my heart. I know it's very close to your heart, the Big Change Charitable Trust. And I've been an ambassador for them since I was around 15.
Right.
So Big Change was founded by Sam and Holly Branson, Princess Beatrice and some of their friends. And it was all about empowering change within the education system. And how can we make sure that our young people don't just thrive in exams, but they thrive in life. So I had been working with Big Change for a while, and they had basically connected with Virgin Unite to bring together a team of, I would say, global changers, movers and shakers. And they wanted us to come together to create a group for them, what they wanted to call almost like the younger version of the elders. So the elders are this group of like really inspirational people from across the world. Some of them have unfortunately passed on, but you know, these are people that really influence change on a global level, from Nelson Mandela to Kofi Annan, to Jimmy Carter. There's so many people who are part of the elders. So Virgin Unite wanted to create a younger version. So I remember sort of going along to the session. I met Ajaz for the first time. And the way we met is that we all bought our own books. And Ajaz bought me his book that he wrote about
the origins
of like AKQA. Yeah. And sort of like first starting out in terms of like the marketing stuff with Virgin. So I remember reading a book and stuff, and I was really, really interested. And at around the same time, you know, I had set up an initiative called the Radio 101 Extra Youth Council. And this was set up because I noticed that the BBC had something missing. You know, they had two of the most biggest like youth radio stations in the world underneath like their organization. However, when I would connect with them and go into the offices and stuff, their audience was not reflected within their building.
Right.
So what didn't make sense to me is you've got an audience of young people between a certain age bracket. Why don't you have the opinions and voices of those young people added into the conversations when it comes to decision making?
Yeah.
And that was like the number one thing for me that didn't make sense.
Yeah. Listen to the customer.
Yeah, listen to the customer, because without the customer, you don't have a business. So after setting that up, it was really successful. 60% of the young people went on to be employed by the BBC. And, you know, again, we advise them on marketing, on corporate social responsibility. How can you better connect with your audiences? Even the creative side. So up to what would Nick Grimshaw say in the morning on The Breakfast Show when Nick was the presenter, or who should we invite to come on to Charlie Sauce Fire in the booth? So we were basically advising them on content, and some of our young people even participated in a TV advert that we put together with Radio 1, and that was really cool. So following the Radio 1 Youth Council, I had many people sort of telling me, you need to figure out how to turn this into a business. And for me, you know, I was a young person who had a background in youth politics, very, very heavily involved in my community. By the age of 13, I had already set up my first organization. But if we were talking about, you know, creating an income for myself, it was something that was unheard of. Because when I went to school, we never learned about entrepreneurship. We never learned about paying tax. And when I came to the realization, I felt it's because, you know, maybe it was a system, maybe it's down to teachers, but especially where I was from, we weren't seen as people that could run our own business. We were not taught about tax because it was never a thing that was meant for us, I don't think. So even in terms of the curriculum, you know, we don't even have a curriculum that fully prepares us for life. And again, we can have like, you know, the core subjects that we obviously need in terms of like basic day-to-day skills. But when it comes to it, if we're talking about practical life skills, from first aid is an example. I learned it in Army Cadets, and I found myself in a situation where I had to use my skills to like help save someone's life. And that was like an example of a skill, a core life skill that I felt should be taught within schools. And luckily, you know, years have gone by since that incident, and now it's actually been like rolled across all schools in the UK. So all young people have access to first aid training. So that's like a perfect example, but we could go into tax, we could go into financial education. You know, we're not taught about credit scores. We're not taught about really important, vital things. So, sort of going back to the original point, you know, I came to the office, you know, after meeting Ajaz at the think tank. And I had an opportunity to present to both of you. I remember walking in. I was so nervous, Sam. Sam, like, I was so, so nervous because...
Well, you nailed it. You did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. I think by then I had already secured my first ever client, and it actually happened to be Rolls Royce, funnily enough. But the way it happened is even just like the bigger picture. And if I could share it quickly, I sort
of... Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
I sort of started by sending out emails to different people. And I sent about 30 emails to 30 different companies, to 30 different CEOs. And I'm going to share a story with you that I was told by someone, and this actually led me to contacting the CEOs. So I sent out 30 emails, Sam.
Yeah, and how many replies?
Emails, I think I only received one response. Like one response. And this was even after. So I think I even sent 30, and then the email that I got a response from was 31. So I remember giving up at that point. I sent out about 30, and I made them personalized, Sam, because the one thing you must say as, you know, a partner and director within a company is cold emailing.
Yeah.
It must happen quite a few times where someone might just copy and paste the email and send it to you. But I noticed that, you know, that can be seen as like really sort of like annoying, and
you can tell a mile off. It's good that they're personalized. Yeah,
immediately. So I made sure I personalized every single email. So again, I personalized 30 emails, received zero responses, and I was so upset. I wanted to give up. And my friend Daryl sort of sat down with me and said, brother, you know, if you don't email them, it's 100% no. But if you email them, you're either going to get a yes or no. So that's a 50% chance. And he said, if you hold back because you feel no one's going to respond to you, that one person that could respond to you, you're missing out on your chance.
Right.
And that really sort of impacted me because, again, sometimes in life, we automatically don't want to do something because we feel it's not for us, or we feel we're not good enough, or we feel it's never going to happen. Like the majority of things that have happened in my life, whether it's traveling the world, engaging with amazing companies like AKQA and yourself, meeting incredible people, I wouldn't have had any of those experiences if I felt I wasn't good enough, if I felt, you know, it isn't for me. Maybe I shouldn't reach out to that person. Maybe I shouldn't send that email because there's no point. And again, I was at that point, and that was me. I'm sort of describing myself. So after Daryl said this to me, I researched the next company that I wanted to email. It was Rolls Royce. And immediately, the first thing that struck me is it was a much bigger company than I expected. I didn't realize that they're a massive sort of engineering and power and energy company. You know, loads of people only know Rolls Royce for the cars. They don't actually know in the UK they employ, or sort of through their work, third-party employ 1 in 200 people in the UK. So like massive workforce. So I've looked into Rolls Royce and I said, there is no way on earth Warren East is going to respond to this email. But I sent the email to him. I sent it on my birthday. So I had a conversation with Daryl on my birthday. And on the 21st of June, the following day, I woke up, I checked my inbox. I saw an email from Warren East, but initially I thought it was a bounce back that it didn't get delivered. When I selected the email, I think it was a short and simple message. You know, love to hear what you've been doing. I'm going to connect you with the appropriate person at Rolls Royce. And I remember reading that sort of thinking, like, I think I even got emotional, Sam, because I had tried so hard, like so hard. And the company that I least expected out of the 30 was the company that said yes.
Yeah.
And that to me really taught me a lesson. And what I was really happy about is that after I met Ajaz through the think tank with Virgin Unite and Big Change, you know, he gave me the opportunity to come down to the offices to pitch to the both of you.
Yeah.
And I'm forever grateful. And the reason I'm forever grateful is because...
Very kind.
sometimes you just need that one push and that one budge, and you need that one person to believe in you. And really and truly, Sam, like, I've got to be honest, in terms of my business, it wasn't, when I first came to you guys, it wasn't like the best sort of scoped out, everything's on point, you know, it wasn't the best. I had no prior business experience. So I was almost learning along the way, but the guys at AK Coin sort of encouraged me and still supported me, and they saw the value in what we were doing. Yeah. So even though the service, if I'm being honest, when I first started my consultancy, again, not being used to business, I think in terms of structure and organization, those are like the two main things as a business we needed to work on. But the one thing that I was forever confident on is that we could hone in these incredible opinions from young people. And that always stood out. So just let the listeners know, I came in to see Sam and Ajaz on, I think it was a Thursday afternoon.
After school, Ajaz, I think it was.
Yeah, it was the Thursday afternoon. The first afternoon, Ajaz and Sam gave me my first opportunity, paid opportunity also, because, you know, many people might say, oh, let's just sort of do this, see how it goes. I received my first paid opportunity the same day, and I had to deliver two focus groups the following Monday. So
demanding clients, you see.
I remember sort of going into a meeting thinking maybe we'll have a couple more emails, we'll have a few more conversations. And I was thrown straight into work. And to me, it was an incredible feeling because it was the first time that I had to work under pressure. But secondly, I was forever grateful because, again, it was sending those 30 emails without a response, doing the work with Rolls-Royce. And again, I was sort of naturally doing it myself anyway. So I would always get invited to like sit down with organizations. I was working in the music industry with a record label called Disturb in London, which was co-founded by Tiny Temper and his manager, Dumi. So I had experience, but again, it wasn't to the level that a company like AKQA, the level they're on to sort of look at a 16-year-old and say, look, we believe in you. We're going to give you an opportunity. Let's go.
Going back to your point, you know, you said that, you know, maybe things weren't as polished as they could be when you came in. But I think the big thing for us is that, you know, people buy people and who they believe in and believe they've got the drive and they want to work with. And I think that's exactly what we saw in you. And I think when you go back to that point about sending emails to CEOs, I think everyone, especially in my position, you know, we were all in that same position many years ago looking for that first break, and we should never forget that. And so when people do email you and they personalize it and they say, you know, could we meet? Could we have a coffee? What do you think of this? Can you help? We should never forget that we were in that position and we needed that big break. And therefore, I always try and reply to people or meet them or give them advice, because it just takes, like you said, it takes that one big break. And I remember my big break when I was in the music industry, and I did a music degree, and I was at university and I was looking for that big break. And I sent an email out to East West Records because they were an amazing label at the time. And they came back and said, yeah, we'll give you 2 weeks work experience. The amount of contacts I made from those 2 weeks kind of launched the rest of my career. And kind of if I go back through my career now, I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't have had that break at that time. So what can you just talk about what reverse mentorship is and how it works and what benefits companies have seen from it?
So reverse mentoring to me, you know, there was something that didn't quite make sense when I was growing up. And it was almost, not saying that mentoring didn't work, because I've had some incredible mentors and without them, I wouldn't be where I am today. But I think in terms of mentoring, it was more based on age. I felt, why is my mentor only my age, my mentor, because they're older than me? And that to me didn't make sense, that it's just down to age thing, because I felt that as a young person, I had tons of knowledge that many people who were a few years older than me did not have. And maybe it's down to a number of different factors. It could be down to like technology and the fact that in this short period of time and the time that I grew up as a young person, you know, there was this massive technological boom. You know, you've got social media, you've got all of that stuff happening. It could be down to like environment and things that I've experienced. So again, that's sort of where the idea for reverse mentoring came. So what we actually do, we go into companies, we set up a new program called Mirror Mentor. And initially we were actually totally doing the reverse mentor way. So we would have the young person mentor the adult, but we felt that there's always room for people to add. And within that scenario, you know, you had the young person mentoring the adult or the executive. And yeah, at times it felt like the executive was also adding to the young people. So right. I didn't want it to be a thing where it was like a one-way thing. I sort of said to myself, how can we make this a neutral thing? And we came up with the concept for something that we call Mirror Mentoring. So Mirror Mentoring, I set up Mirror Mentor with an entrepreneur, veteran TV producer and Forbes columnist, a guy called Remy Blumenfeld. And me and Remy are sort of from completely different walks of life. You know, when he was 18, he had the opportunity to go to New York. His parents were really, really successful. His mom's a really famous artist. And he went on to build, you know, these companies that went on to do really well. He sold his first production company to Endemol. Completely sort of different upbringing. But when me and Remy connected for the first time and I was sort of speaking about my life and some of the things that I experienced, it was like a total shock because, again, I feel there's so many issues that happen in the UK that affect young people, but they're not always spoken about. So there's loads of underlying issues that are happening right underneath our noses. And when I shared some of my experiences with Remy, it really made him think from a different perspective. And in the same way, he sort of gave me advice on my business and how to like sort of take it off the ground. So initially with reverse mentoring, we actually put a program together with Nando's. It was like a really, really incredible experience and a lot of chicken, loads of chicken. but I think in terms of Nando's, it was quite, like one-sided. As I mentioned earlier, so in terms of Mirror Mentor, we've gone on to select a number of different execs in loads of different industries. We've also identified a number of young people who will be in this Mirror Mentor relationship with them. And what it entails is just meeting up once quarterly, sort of catching up within that 3-month window, and sort of just going through our program guide. So instead of just throwing people into the deep end, we actually provide them with like a pack that guides them just so they can get the best out of it.
Right.
And get the most out of it.
So we've got 10 minutes left and I would love to talk to you about your auto.
So fast.
I'd love to talk to you about your autobiography, which is out in August this year, Dreaming in a Nightmare, Finding a Way Forward in a World That's Holding You Back. Did you ever dream that one day you'd be publishing an autobiography?
Sam, I'll be totally honest with you. I never ever thought I would become a writer. It just wasn't part of the equation. And, you know, being able to write a whole entire book, you know, I got offered to work with like another writer at the beginning, like a ghostwriter. And again, it's like quite normal in like the literary world. However, I wanted to sort of just do it alone. I felt it would be more authentic and it's coming straight from the heart. So literally the whole of last year, I was putting this book together. I entitled it Dreaming in a Nightmare. And it was for a specific reason. And it isn't even saying that where I grew up in Brixton was a nightmare. Brixton is now a lovely place, you know.
Right.
If you go to Brixton right now, it's completely changed. There's been a lot of gentrification as well. Like, it's not the same. But when I was growing up in Brixton, it was a sort of different place. But it still isn't saying Brixton's a nightmare. It's saying that my environment and my experiences were a nightmare to me. So how could I dream within this place? And that was the whole thing for me. You know, I felt that life around me became a complete nightmare. And to give you an example of why I actually thought about the book, and again, it links into Big Change. I was sort of in a Big Change building and we were discussing Stop and Search. And it was topical in the news. So when we were sort of around the table having lunch, I sort of spoke about my experiences. And I sort of said, yeah, I've been stopped and searched about 7 or 8 times. I sort of explained how it's like humiliating. And
so this is by the police, right? So this is by the police force in London.
Yeah. So I mentioned how it's like humiliating, degrading. People that pass you automatically think you're a criminal. And I'm talking about on foot. So not like driving a car and you get pulled over for like a regular check. I'm talking, you're just walking casually on the street. Police jump out of a police van. They stop you, handcuff you, and they search you because apparently you fit a description most of the time. So not saying the police are doing a bad job whatsoever. And this discussion had nothing to do about the job of the police. It was just more that I was casually, openly speaking about this. And to me, it was totally normal. You know, I could probably walk through Brixton right now, Angel Town Estate. If I'm walking around for about 10 minutes, I'll probably get spotted on the camera and they'll probably just want to know what I'm up to. So I've said it like it's so casual, like it's so normal to me. And I'm explaining it to everyone around the table. But the reaction that everyone was giving to me, they were so upset. They couldn't believe that I had to experience any of that stuff. And everyone was in disbelief. But I realized if I would have been having this conversation with my friends from school or college or people that I grew up with, we would probably make a joke out of it, or we would be laughing, or we would just be sharing all of our experiences. And what I came to realize is, you know, I was so desensitized, not just from this scenario, but from many different issues that were affecting young people. And young people shouldn't have to experience some of the things that we've had to experience growing up, like me when I grew up with my friends. But we were so desensitized that we didn't realize it was wrong. A prime example for me, I've lost many friends due to youth violence. And it's a topic that I've campaigned on since the age of 13. So I'm 20 now. So 7 or 8 years of my life. And youth violence for me, like, in terms of like the complexities, it expands far beyond what we could discuss in there. We could be here for hours. even in terms of like demographic and stuff, I feel in the media and stuff, it does look like it is specific demographics that are affected. But when you actually delve into the stats, it's a massive problem across the UK. You can go to Merseyside, you can go to the West Midlands, you can even go to, well, Glasgow has improved a lot. But about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, Glasgow was the most violent city in Europe until they sort of fixed it up over there. So again, going back to like the original conversation, what I came to realize is I was so desensitized. I didn't think there was anything wrong with anything that I was experiencing. And that was until I've mentioned stop and search and no one could believe it happened to me. And later on that day, Essie, who sort of leads the work that Big Change does, took me to the side. And Essie got really upset. And she sort of described to me why she was upset. And she sort of felt upset because I was a young person who she knew. She knew me as a bubbly character, but she never, ever imagined any of that stuff happening to me. And it was at that moment that I realized that my reality, even your reality, Sam, the reality of any of us, could be seen as a complete nightmare to somebody else. Right. So what is so normal to all of us, you know, it doesn't even have to necessarily be in relation to like a young person like myself or someone who's come from an environment I've come from. I feel that everyone can fall into that whole nightmare bracket, and your reality can be seen as a nightmare to someone else. So that was the thing that I realized in this book. And in summary, I talk about my life. I use my life as like a timeline to talk about all of these different issues. You know, I talk about homelessness, immigration, I talk about politics, I talk about crime and violence, I talk about the education system, all of the things that have affected me. And yeah, the book sort of starts with my mother's story about why she left Nigeria to come to the UK and how she had us here and how she sort of tried to make a life for herself. And then it goes into my life when I grew up and some of the things I experienced. So maybe I'll give 2 examples. For example, when I had the conversation about stop and search, I was around 16 at the time I was about 18 at the time when we were discussing this. But I got searched when I was 15, this exact moment I was describing. So when I was 15, I said to them, you know, I was walking through my area and I was stopped and searched. I was put in the back of a police van and it was far from the best experience, Sam. Far from the best experience. Like, it was just absolutely humiliating. And I've described this to everyone around the table. And then I described the fact that a couple of days earlier, I was actually in 10 Downing Street with the Prime Minister, then David Cameron, having a reception and getting an opportunity to help switch on the Christmas lights on the tree outside.
Unbelievable. And
when I shared this story to everyone around the table, again, I'm so desensitized, Sam. Again, cool. I did go through with like the complaints procedure and all of that, but I was so desensitized that I couldn't put the fact together that I was with the Prime Minister, let's say on a Monday, just to figure out a speech. I don't know the exact day, but I'm with the Prime Minister on Monday. And then Friday, I'm walking through Brixton in the back of a police van getting searched. And to think how crazy that juxtaposition is.
That's insane.
You know, another example is when we were on the last sort of Strive Challenge. And a lot of people that were participating didn't know this, but one of my childhood friends actually passed away a couple of weeks before the Strive Challenge. Right. So when we actually went away, I had the opportunity to do something special. And the thing that I done, I went up to Sir Richard Branson and I said that I had an idea. And we had a few conversations over that period of like 2 weeks we were together. And I said, it would be great if you could surprise my mom on FaceTime. So my mother, who's this figure all of you are going to learn about in the book, you know, we basically called her and then I sort of said, hi, mom, someone wants to speak to you. And it was Sir Richard Branson telling my mom how great I was to him. And at that moment, I was so, that was like the biggest achievement I've ever achieved, you know, from awards, certificates. When I was in the New Year's honors list, like this was like the biggest thing for me, because my mom, as an individual, when we were growing up, she would always use people as examples, whether it was a family friend, the pastor's daughter, or even up to like someone like Richard Branson. She would just be like, why can't you be like Richard Branson? Look at someone like him who's building this company, that company. So when I had the opportunity to face him, it was incredible.
Yeah, but I bet she was proud, right?
Yeah, she was over the moon. Nelly brought to tears.
Oh, amazing.
A couple of hours after that, Sam, I remember this was like my final day because I'd done half of the challenge with the core team. And I went to my hotel room and I picked up my phone and I was sort of going on social media and on the Strive Challenge, like during the same amount of time, my friend that had passed away, his funeral had happened when I was away in Corsica. So I remember after the video, me taking a video, because I didn't post it straight away. So it was on my phone for about 3 or 4 weeks until the Strive Challenge was like concluded. And I remember just looking at it on my phone and then going on social media excited because I'm about to post it. And then I came across my friend's funeral. I came across some of the highlights and it just really brought me to tears, like there on the spot, because I was this young guy from Brixton who had the opportunity to be around some of the most successful people in the world, you know, at the same time raising money for a charity very, very close to my heart, tackling issues that I'm very, very passionate about.
Yeah.
However, you know, I had someone back home who was exactly like me, who came from the same place like me. And unfortunately, we had crossed paths when we had separated paths when we were 16, because after secondary school, you sort of like go to like different colleges and stuff if you don't stay in the sixth form. And it just hit me that I was almost like dreaming in this nightmare. I had this fantastic moment and now I'm back to the nightmare. And that is sort of like the key theme throughout the book. Some of these crazy juxtapositions, us talking about all of these issues. And again, it's about solutions. I didn't want to create a book just talking about problems. It has some real deep core solutions to combat some of these issues I discussed.
Right. Jeremiah, you've been through so much. What advice would you have to other young people out there today who feel directly affected by the pandemic in some way, be that socially or emotionally?
my advice is, you know, now is the time to sort of think about yourself first and to think about your friends and family. I think for me, this time has just brought me closer to everyone. I think as life goes by, we often forget the important things. We forget the important people in our lives. And I would say the first thing, no matter how you're feeling, sort of think about your well-being and the well-being of your friends and family at this time. I think the second thing for me, and it went back into us talking earlier about like the business pages and the influencers, and I do really think now is the time to be productive. You know, again, I was at a place a few weeks ago where, Sam, I was on the total edge, like, because my business was about to collapse, because remember, we primarily do focus groups. So if there's social distancing and lockdown, how are we supposed to, you know, deliver our focus groups?
Right.
So that was the first thing for me that impacted me. You know, unfortunately, there was, I lost my godmother and there was some crazy stuff going on. So I was very, very low. And at this point, I think this was just before we connected to talk about the podcast. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, I can't just sit here. You know, I think they extended the lockdown for another 3 weeks. And I was just saying to myself, there's no way I can just be at home doing nothing. So what I'd done, and this piece of paper is still in front of me on my wall, courtesy of AKQA, because you guys, a quick one, this is a complete detour, but you guys have some magic paper that you just stick on the wall, and I fell in love with it. I got all the love of it from Amazon now. No blue tack, no nothing, you just stick it on. So I had to plant it in.
It's great stuff, static paper.
So again, like, I've got this massive piece of paper on my wall, and I said, what can I do? What can I do at this current time that can generate an income for me? You know, I was lucky enough, you know, I've sort of improved my savings. So just before all of this stuff happened, you know, I was in a really good place. But I had to sort of think to myself, what can I do as of now? And there was two options. Number one, I was heavily involved in the music industry. So I run my own startup called Just Entertainment. So we sort of do events, we manage a number of different acts, and we distribute people as well.
Right.
So I thought, cool, music, the live industry is totally destroyed. You know, we can't go to radio stations, we can't be on the road to do promo. So the only thing we can do is just release music on DSPs. So digital service providers like Spotify and iTunes and stuff. So that was the first idea I had. And the second was, cool, we've got something incredible here. You know, now is the time for brands to be speaking to young people. You know, we're in an unprecedented time and young people have never experienced what we're experiencing now, ever in a lifetime. What I think is super, super important now is, whereas, you know, behavior will change, you know, people's trends, their buying trends, what they do, because there's going to be so many changes. I thought to myself, now's the time that brands should really be speaking to young people. It's super important. So I said to myself, we can't have focus groups. What exactly can we do? So me and the team are currently thinking about how we can sort of capitalize on that. So two ideas I have on this big piece of paper, and it was just about how can I be productive in this time. So my record label side of things, again, this was just something I was doing for 2 years in my spare time. If someone wanted to release a song online, I'll probably just release it for them, make a few phone calls. Maybe they'll get radio support and playlisted on Spotify.
Right.
After deciding this was what I wanted to do in quarantine, it's suddenly gone from me doing that in my spare time to me actually bringing the whole team together for us to find new music. And we've created a partnership with Sony Music. So we're actually now going to be working with them to distribute through their distributor called The Orchard. And again, that's only because of the pandemic. If I was never in this space currently, I would have never thought about setting up the record label in full, and I would have never received this opportunity from Sony. And I think the second thing, in terms of consultancy, again, we've decided, yes, maybe now is the most important time for opinions. So we're currently just thinking about ways of making the consultancy go online. How can we make it digital? And we're currently just basically putting a structure together in which we can do our focus groups online and our think tanks.
Do you think your childhood and the fact you have an entrepreneurial mindset has helped you get through these challenging times that we're going through?
1,000,000%. I don't know where I would be if I didn't think in this way. Like right now, like every single day I wake up, I sort of read out my life purpose statement, which is this paragraph that I put together that I sort of read to myself every single morning to remind myself of what my purpose is. And yeah, sort of following that, I sort of get on with the day, but I sort of think about like entrepreneurial ideas. So like on every other day, I sort of speak to different people. And again, I've sort of been advising people in my consultancy capacity about how they can capitalize off their skills. So yeah, like if I didn't have that mentality and if I couldn't think and imagine, I just feel right now, I would feel like I'm in prison because I wouldn't be able to leave my house. I wouldn't be able to do anything else. So it's really just the creative mind that has kept me going.
Thanks again, Jeremiah, for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been an absolute pleasure again to host you on AKQA Insight and to hear everything you've got to say. And as always, I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.